Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
The best advice I got from my editor was at the start, don't fall into the same mistakes that a lot of first-time children's book authors do. Don't write about animals. Don't write rhymes unless you're really, really good at writing rhymes.
Kenji took his editor's advice, and so there are no animals or rhymes in his new children's book, Every Night is Pizza Night. We'll also hear from librarian Betsy Bird, who tells us that children's books and food go together like, well, green eggs and ham. And Kenji will be back with some truly giving holiday gift picks, all coming right up on Special Sauce.
Today, it is my great pleasure to welcome my longtime running partner, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. Kenji is truly a 21st century Renaissance person. He is the best-selling author of the Food Lab book, the host of the enormously popular YouTube channel, Kenji's Cooking Show, Serious Eats chief culinary consultant, and now the author of the children's book, Every Night is Pizza Night. Something close to my heart, illustrated by Gianna Ruggiero. So good to have you on, my friend. So good to have you on.
Thanks, Ed. It's good to be back.
Yeah. We should just do this like every week, and then we would be caught up all the time.
Yes.
I really have to start with the children's book because, I mean, you and I have known each other a long time. We've worked together on and off since, what, 2008? Maybe 2009, and I never heard you talk about an urge to write a children's book. So,
well, I didn't have a child at the time.
Got it. So how did it come about, and what made you think you could do it?
Well, it came about, I mean, because I had a child, and I wanted to write a book for her. What made me think I could do it? I mean, I don't know. Foolishness. It was definitely much more difficult to write this book than it was to write The Food Lab. Maybe not as lengthy a process, but the actual, you know, the learning I had to do. I thought to myself, oh, children's book, that's easy. I'll just, you know, it's just a children's book. And then you start actually writing and you're like, oh, wait a minute. It's actually really hard to tell a story in like 1,000 words or less and have it not be dumb, you know?
Yeah, and you're used to, you write long in general.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Brevity is not my thing.
and so that's really the first question. It's like, I guess in a way, it's like you learn as a line cook how to reduce sauces. Is there a parallel in writing a children's book?
There is a couple parallels, actually. You know, like a lot of it is just editing, tons and tons of editing, because what you have to do is you have to start with a good story. And the story that I wrote in this book, it went through many, many iterations, but at some point it was like 10,000 words long, because I'm like, okay, I'm just going to write out the story as I want it and try and get all the main points. And then from there, it's really heavy duty editing. You know, it's like a normal story for a newspaper gets edited a lot, but a children's story, you really have to let word efficiency is the most important thing. And you have to really figure out what the important messages are, how to get the feeling across without using too many words. And then, you know, just like in a kitchen, you know, if you want to go with the reducing sauce metaphor, you have to trust your teammates in the kitchen. And with a children's book, you know, there are children's book authors, but the illustrator is easily just as important, if not more important than the words, you know, the illustrations in the book, because they're doing most of the heavy lifting as far as getting the feel of the story across and all these little things that you want in there as far as feeling and messaging goes that don't fit into the 20 words that you can put on each page. So working really closely with an illustrator, and luckily I found an amazing illustrator. I mean, Gianna is...
How did you find Gianna?
Twitter.
Of course.
I went on Twitter and I said, I'm looking for an illustrator to help me write a book. And a bunch of people emailed me and she was one of them.
Welcome to Kenji's methodology for life.
Everything is crowdsourced. Yeah. She was an illustrator she's actually in the video game industry. So she designs characters and stuff for video games. But, you know, her portfolio was great. You can tell just by looking at her pictures that she has, you know, fully formed characters in her head when she's drawing. The characters that she draws and that I saw in her portfolios, it's like you can imagine the worlds that they live in without any words at all. And I think that's really important to have enough skill and visual style and have enough of an opinion. what she brought to these characters is much more multifaceted than even, you know, than I imagined them to be. You know, because the character now, it's not just something coming out of my head. It's now two of us are working together,
right,
to develop a character. And so her illustrations really bring the whole thing to life. So yeah, writing a children's story, it's a lot about editing and then a lot about trusting your illustrator and collaborating.
I assume the editing process starts with you, right? So you wrote 10,000 words and then you looked it over and it goes, okay, what am I really trying to say? And what can I do to distill this story into 1,000 words or whatever?
Like, yeah, well, really it starts with reading a ton. You know, when I started writing this, I crowdsourced lists of children's books that people enjoyed for kids of that age, and particularly books about food. So I bought like close to 100 books and read them before I even started writing. I also read them to Alicia, to my daughter, to see which ones connected with her the most, tried to take the most lessons from those.
And did you also hearken back to your own childhood?
Yeah, I did. Just as I sort of, in my food writing, I try and take influence from some of my favorite writers, food or otherwise. Yeah, I definitely thought back to some of my favorite books as a kid. But it's also like, usually what I try and get from other writers is humor. That's what I connect with most in other people's writing. And if a book can make me laugh, then I try and figure out what it is that makes me laugh. And then I try and incorporate those kinds of jokes in my own writing. So, you know, the kinds of jokes I include in this book, in the children's book, Every Night is Pizza Night, are not really that different from the types of jokes that I include in my food writing.
I noticed that. You know, I had a friend who died named Jeff Moss. I've told you about Jeff. He wrote Rubber Ducky. So he was one of the main Sesame Street writers.
Right.
And he wrote amazing children's books. And he used to talk about what they did in the writer's room at Sesame Street was just try to make each other laugh. Instead of like, oh, would this be funny to a kid? He said it never worked when they tried to do it that way.
Right. Well, you know what I've found interacting with my daughter, who's now 3.5, is that there are the obvious things that all kids find funny, like pee and poop jokes. Like she likes saying pee all the time, but she likes to laugh when she sees us laughing, right? And oftentimes, like, she'll crack up at something and then afterwards ask me, Papa, why is that funny? And I try and explain to her what the joke is. But I think the key to a good kids book is that the parents have to have fun reading it, right?
Right.
Because kids have fun when they see their parents having fun. So it has to be something that the parents can enjoy. It's the same as a good kid's song, right? It's like it can't be annoying to the parents. It has to be something that the parents are going to enjoy. And that's what gives a song like Rubber Ducky longevity, right? It's clever. It's funny. It's good for kids, but it's also like just clever as an adult to listen to the rhymes and stuff in it. And the music's not annoying other than the middle section with all the squeaking. But so like in my book, it's full of silly puns, the way my adult writing is. But it also has like pop culture references, right? There's like, there's lines from like Eddie Izzard and Ghostbusters that kids are not going to get, but parents are hopefully going to find funny and laugh along with it. And then when kids see their parents laughing, they like to laugh too.
Yeah, I was struck when you first sent me, which was a long time ago, the book, how much of it really was distilled from your writing style in your regular work life. I used to describe your writing for the site as Harold McGee meets The Simpsons. And I'm not so sure we could substitute something else for Harold McGee, but it still meets The Simpsons, you know, in a way.
Yeah, with the references, too.
Yeah. I guess the other thing is that you didn't mention the reason it has to, that the adults have to like it, is because if your kid likes it, you're not going to be reading it to them once.
Oh, no. Yes. Kids, especially, you know, at that age, 2, 3, 4 years old, like, they're learning how the world works. And so they like to have things repeated to them over and over and over. And so my daughter constantly requests that I tell her, whether it's reading a book or, you know, or we like to talk about it. Right now, she's really into Norse mythology. And every day, like at breakfast, she's like, Papa, can we talk about the gods? I'm like, sure. And I tell her the same, like, 3 stories that she requests every time. It's the same as it is with cooking. Also, it's like she helps out in the kitchen a lot, but she likes to repeat the same things. So not necessarily the same recipes, but it's like right now she's really into peeling. And so like at every meal, we have to either give her a carrot or a cucumber or something that she can peel because she's like practicing her peeling skills. And I guess it's similar to adults, but especially with kids, it's like they're, everything is so new that they like to have that sort of stability and the same thing happen with predictable results repeatedly until they really get it, you know?
So tell me about the nature of your collaboration with Gianna, because that's also something you've never done before. What was the back and forth like? And did it take a while to establish a rhythm that worked for both of you?
It did. You know what I did was I actually reached out to our mutual friend, Alex Penfold, who's written for Serious Eats, and she's a children's book author and editor. She came out with last year, was it last year? Maybe 2 years ago, with a book called Food Truck Fest, which I think is probably based on the Serious Eats food festival.
Yes.
Because in it, they go out to an island and there's food trucks on the island. Like, to me, I was like, oh, this is about the food truck, food festival that Serious Eats had. But anyhow, I talked to her about her process working with an illustrator, and she gave me a lot of good pointers. But, you know, what I discovered was that at first I wanted to be super controlling. You know, I would say, all right, these are the words on the page. This is where they're going to go. I'm putting like natural breaks and I'm describing exactly the pictures that need to be on each page. You know, and that I sent over to Alex Penfold, and she's like, if you're working with an illustrator, you need to collaborate with them. Like, you should put more faith in them and give them less direction, which I thought was wonderful advice. You know, so basically at the end of it, with Gianna, what I first sent over to her was just the words on each page. I described who the characters were. You know, I gave her like one sheet of paper just describing who the characters in the story were, what their personalities were like, and then basically just let her go with that. And what you find then is that they have a different interpretation of your words than you ever intended, but oftentimes they find things that you didn't even know were there. And so collaborating with Gianna was really like me putting the story down and then letting her kind of run wild with it. And then from there, both of us editing on both sides, you know, editing the words to fit the pictures, editing the pictures to fit the words, until we got somewhere that we were both happy with.
Yeah.
So it's really just putting a lot of faith in your collaborator. We've talked about doing other kids' books now as well. So one thing that she's doing now is, like, you know, she has a few illustrations that she loves. There's one, if you can actually go on her website, GiannaRuggiero.com, she has a portfolio. But in that portfolio, there's one picture of a little girl wearing a red hat who's talking to an alligator in the middle of a swamp, right? And she didn't have any story in mind for that, but she loves that illustration. She sent it to me and she's like, you know, like, I love this illustration. Like, let's see if we can come up with a story about this. So, you know, now in the process of thinking of writing new books, we're kind of working from both directions, where I have some ideas for kids' stories that I want to put into words, and she has pictures that she wants to write stories around. So I'm hoping that in the future, you know, other books that we work on together will be even more collaborative than this first one was.
It sounds like for you, it's sort of a unique collaboration. You collaborate on everything you do in one way or another, but not quite in this way, because this is really a collaboration between equals.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it absolutely is. It makes me look at kids' books and think about the books I loved as a kid. And, you know, many of them are illustrated and written by the same person, you know, like Mo Willems, who writes for Sesame Street. He has all of his pigeon books, and he has a great book called Nanette's Baguettes. He has a ton of all the elephant and piggy books, and he does the illustrations and the words. But it made me realize that, like, some of my other favorite books, I didn't really know who the illustrators were. I only ever paid attention to the author's name, and which I think is almost a travesty now, because it's like, it didn't occur to me how much the illustrators work on the stories as much as the author does, assuming most collaborations are similar to my own. But, you know, so for me, it was really important that, like, on the cover of our book, that it's not like Kenji Lopez Alt's book with Gianna Ruggiero, that it's written by both of us. And to make sure that people understand, hey, this is a full collaboration. Like, we both have an important role to play in bringing this to life.
During the process, did you run into any big roadblocks? Were there any particular challenges that you had to overcome or deal with, or was it fairly smooth?
Well, there were big roadblocks. You know, like I said, the writing the story was more difficult for me than writing a 1,000-page food book.
Right.
Thinking about the story from a kid's perspective, as I was saying before, like, it, you know, it does try and make sure that it's fun for adults to read as well. But you do really have to, at the same time, put yourself in a 3-year-old's shoes to figure out what sort of messages make sense and to think about the ways in which they interact with the world and write from the perspective of a child.
Yeah.
Getting that voice right. I guess that was the big thing, is getting the voice. It's the same as any writing. It's like, you know, you got to figure out what's going to connect with your readers, but also what makes it unique to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a normal food writing voice, right? Like, I know how to write like myself,
right?
When I'm writing about frying a chicken or something. And, you know, luckily I found that voice pretty early on in my career, but some people have big difficulty finding that voice. And with the children's book, it was really just a matter of, like, forcing myself to sit down every single night. You know, what I did was I brought my laptop into the restaurant, three or four nights a week after Alicia was in bed. I would come to the restaurant, sit there with my laptop and just write for 3 or 4 hours every night, a few nights a week. And it's, you know, it's just through the sheer volume, you eventually refine your voice until it's at a place where you think you like it. But I think it's the same advice anyone gives writers, which is you just got to do it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's a question I've always had about children's book authors. Do the themes and messages drive the story? Like, which comes first?
This one started with the theme first. You know, originally, my very first idea was like, okay, this is going to be an ABC book with foods from all around the world. So the theme of the book was always about multiculturalism and food from around the world, which is what it ended up being. Mm-hmm. Then I started talking with my editors and they're like, well, there's a lot of ABC books. Like, why don't you try writing a story instead? And so it's like, okay, then I have to think of a character. So it started with the theme. And from there, it moved into becoming a story. And once I had that theme, like the theme of multiculturalism, then it seemed relatively obvious that the challenge of the story should be about a character who is not into trying new things. You have to think of relatively simple themes for a kid's book. So a theme about a kid trying new foods and being exposed to different cultures and different people through trying new foods, I think, is one that I'm familiar with, having grown up in a multicultural family and in a multicultural city. So one that I felt like I could write about and one that would connect with a lot of kids, and particularly the kids of my sort of adult audience, you know, because the recipes that I write for like Serious Eats are from all over the world. You know, I enjoy traveling and I enjoy learning about food from all over the world. And so it seemed relatively obvious to me that I should stick with what I know for my first book.
And did you ever get to the point of being so frustrated by this new process that you were like, maybe I can't do this?
No, I never thought I can't do this. I did think many, many times, if I do this, it's not going to be very good. I did think many times, oh man, this right. is just not good. Like even if it's done, it'll get out there and it's not going to be something I'm proud of. There were definitely times when I was like, I can do this, but I'm not going to be able to do it very well. But at the end of the day, it's like, I wrote it for my daughter. She loves it when I read it to her. She requests it. So who cares about everything else? You know, it's reached the audience that it was intended for already. I mean, the audience it's intended for already likes it. So whatever it does and whatever reviews it gets or however well it sells, it's already a success.
And I will say that from what I know of your daughter, she's very discerning, very particular, and very opinionated.
Unlike her parents.
The apple never falls far from the tree. So one question also is about the role mm-hmm. that an editor plays in a children's book. Talk a little bit about that, because you've had experience in dealing with magazine editors and editors at Serious Eats and newspapers. But what role did the publishing house's editor play in this book?
Obviously, there's layout and fixing words and all that stuff that editors do after you turn in a manuscript. But the best advice I got from my editor was at the start. You know, I'd never really worked in the genre before. And actually, Norton, my publisher, just started their children's book division. And they hired on a children's book editor. And it was the only children's book editor that Norton had ever had. Most of the advice I got was making sure that I don't fall into the same mistakes that a lot of first-time children's book authors do. It's very broad advice. It's like, don't write about animals. Start with human characters that are easier to do than animal characters. Don't write rhymes unless you're really, really good at writing rhymes. Oh, it's like some of my favorite children's books, they rhyme or they're about animals. And it's like, there are great children's books about animals and there are great children's books with rhyming stanzas. But there are so many more bad ones. You have selective memory about children's books. And so if you can do animals and if you can do rhyming, then great. But most people can't do it. That was like the number one piece of advice, because honestly, like I started out writing everything rhyming because I'm just like, oh yeah, like of course, like I'll write it like a song. It'll be easier to say. It'll be easier for kids to remember. It'll be catchier. And so that was the very first thing my editor told me to stop doing. Most of the stuff I got, of the advice I got from my editors was early on in the broader strokes of what makes a good children's story. You know, also the advice to stick to a simple theme, as well as like, you know, general advice on how to cut down a story and really focus on word efficiency.
Yeah, interesting. Could you tell us what your favorite children's books are when you went into this process?
Closest in sort of tone and spirit to what I was going for. There's one called We Don't Need Our Classmates, which is about a baby T-Rex going to school for the first time, goes to a school with humans and eats them and then learns not to eat other kids.
That's a lovely lesson.
There's one called Be Kind, which is, well, about the power of being kind. There's the Shape series by John Klassen. There is Circle, Square, and Triangle, they're called. And they it's a trilogy. But each one of them is a story on its own. And they're like super funny and subversive and wonderful books that kids love, but also as an adult, I think are hilarious. Anyhow, those would be the books that I took the most influence from.
Are there more children's books in your head? Or I know you mentioned that you and Gianna have already talked about other books you might be interested in. So you don't think this is going to be a one-time thing, do you?
I have a list of story ideas that Gianna and I have been bouncing off each other for a while. Right now, I'm focusing on finishing up my next big cookbook, so I probably won't get around to another children's book until next year. But I enjoyed the process, and I definitely want to do more, at least one more, if not several more.
After talking to Kenji about Every Night is Pizza Night, I really want to know more about the intersection of food and children's books. So I reached out to someone who knows an insane amount about children's books, someone who's thoroughly steeped in children's literature. Betsy Bird is a children's book quintuple threat, librarian for both the New York Public Library and now the Evanston, Illinois Public Library, a children's book blogger, a podcaster who, with her sister Kate, hosts a children's book podcast, Fuse 8 and Kate, a children's book editor. She edited a collection of children's stories all written by women called Funny Girl, Funniest Stories Ever. And wait, there's more. An author herself. Betsy's most recent book is The Great Santa Stakeout. Welcome to Special Sauce, Betsy. I think I'm definitely talking to someone who can school me about the role that food plays in children's books. Would you say that's correct?
Oh, yeah. I'm going with that.
So let's start with a little history lesson about the intersection of food and children's books. Food and children's books go together like, well, green eggs and ham?
Ooh, nice. I like how you just pulled that one out. Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the history of children's literature, you're going to see food making its way every which way. And I mean, think about Peter Rabbit. You know, one of the first things that book says is that his father was caught and baked into a pie. The entire book is based on Peter attempting to steal different types of foodstuffs and succeeding. And then he goes to bed and it's all about the food there. He's given chamomile tea, but his sisters get blackberries and cream. Food is one of the things that kids grab onto first when they're reading a book. I have wonderful memories when I was a kid of reading a Tasha Tudor book that had these amazing looking chocolate cupcakes. I would go to that book again and again just to look at the cupcakes. So really, food and books for kids, they're inseparable.
I guess it's also because every kid has a pretty intense relationship with food, whether they're a picky eater or not.
Oh, absolutely. Some of my favorite board books, there's an old Max and Ruby one by Rosemary Wells, where the entire plot centers around whether Max will eat an egg. Fun fact, he will not. He will not eat that egg.
I've mentioned a couple of reasons, but why do you think food is part of so many children's books?
The kids don't have that much going on. They have very little control over anything. They can sort of decide when they sleep, but there's not a lot of pleasure in that. They can't really deny their parents, much their parents are picking them up, giving them baths and making them go to bed at certain times. All this stuff. The one thing, the one sense of power a kid can have is over whether they decide to eat or not eat something. And they wield that power with great aplomb. So, of course, in their books, they're going to immediately gravitate towards eating in some way, whether it's this is food that I already love and therefore I want to read about it, or this is food I have never heard of. I am curious about it, but I at least understand the concept, even from a very young age, of eating. You don't have to explain that to anybody. Very understandable.
So what are some of the most famous and or beloved children's books in which food plays a major role? You already mentioned Peter Rabbit.
And you mentioned green eggs and ham. We once had a famous chef come to New York Public Library, and I was the one charged with finding this guy some books to read. And of course, you don't know if this guy is going to be a good reader or not. So I basically had to find children's books that were about food and that anybody could read. So I basically had to find children's books about food that were slam dunks. And so I pulled Green Eggs and Ham. I eschewed the old Peter Rabbit. But the problem with classic children's books, at least here in America, that have to do with food is they're awfully white. You know, they're written by white authors. They tend to be foods that white people like. So I got out, I consider this a classic, a Bee Bim Bop by Linda Sue Park. That's a fantastic picture book. Anyone can read that. It goes over like gangbusters. But it's actually a little hard to avoid books about food. If you want to hit all the top contenders, you know, you've got James and the Giant Peach, right? You know, you've got Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. That one might be like the quintessential food children's book, I would say. Yeah.
Kenji, when he started this project, told me he read 100 children's books that involve food just so he would be steeped in it. You know, Kenji always does his homework. And it's very interesting that you just mentioned that so many children's book classics are, in fact, written by white people, about white people. And that's one of the messages and themes of Kenji's book, right? Every night is pizza night is a metaphor because every culture has their version of pizza as the protagonist of the book. So talk a little bit more about that, because I think that's one of the main things Kenji wanted to accomplish with Every Night is Pizza Night.
That was the thing I really admired about the book. You know, books that try to draw in different types of foods around the world, they certainly exist. The idea of a common food found in different parts of the world, that's a little rarer. I've seen books where there's one food and it's the same food and it's, you know, it's eaten in this country and it's eaten in this country, but not something like pizza, which was what I thought was really cool about that. I also thought I should just mention, very cool thing about his book is he managed to put an Eddie Izzard joke in there right at the start. So, mwah, well done there. That one's for the adults. And he did the exact right thing when he went reading as many, because that's how you do it. So many people are like, yeah, children's books, 32 pages. How hard can it be? I'll just slap some words on the page and the editor will do the rest. And the thing that I really admired about his book is you can tell. You can absolutely tell that he did put in the work because it doesn't read like a, well, like a celebrity picture book.
Yeah, that's very interesting because he really does do his homework. He genuinely loves children books. He adores being a dad. And I think all those things show through and he never tosses things off. It may seem like they're casual, but they're not. You know, and it's interesting that you picked up on that because I think he steeped himself in not just children's literature, but children's books about food.
Yes.
And it shows. And when I asked, he said, you know, one of the things his editor at Norton said to him, you know, like, start with the theme and then go to the story and the characters. How did you write your book, The Great Santa Stakeout?
That was a really strange situation. In that case, the illustrator approached me, which, number one, you're never supposed to walk into a publisher with an illustrator. That's the number one rule they tell you. He comes to me, he's already a New York Times bestseller, and he says, hey, let's do a picture book together. I've only got one idea, Giants Leaping. And I was like, okay. And we came up with three ideas, and the publisher bought two.
Wow.
That was nice, but that is not the normal way to go about things.
Got it.
What I see a lot of is people who are very successful in their fields, have children, and then think, wow, I'm reading this kid a lot of picture books already. Why don't I make a picture book, have that published, and then I'll have something to read to the kids. It's kind of cool because it's like something I wrote. And so I see, you know, TV writers and, you know, people who've been prominent in their field, you know, politicians and celebrities, and they all do this and they all feel very samey, well-intentioned, but very samey. And he's different. His book was different.
You hear his voice. His voice comes through. in the children's book in the same way that his voice came through in his 900-page cookbook, which is called Food Lab. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And your reference to Eddie Izzard is perfect, right? It's like I used to describe Kenji as Harold McGee meets The Simpsons. It's very pop culture oriented.
And I'm just going to give away for people what it is. There's a moment where the dad at the beginning says, "I long for a grapefruit." There is only one place that line comes from, and that is from the Dress to Kill special that Eddie Izzard did, which I just watched this past Thanksgiving. So it was already in my mind, and then I see it on the page, and I'm like, well done.
So what are some other children's books involving food that people might not have heard of that they should check out? That Korean book that you mentioned, that I'd never heard of.
Oh, Bibimbap? That's wonderful. This is an interesting thing. There's so many picture books these days that have the standard recipe at the back, which was not always the case. There are plenty of books about children's, you know, food from the past that would not include the recipe. On the podcast with my sister, we were looking for a classic Thanksgiving picture book. And I came up with Cranberry Thanksgiving, which is part of a long series. It's a cult favorite, because people who love this book love this book. And the whole thing centers around this grandmother who has this cranberry bread recipe, and everybody's trying to get their hands on it. And then the recipe is in the back of the book. And this book came out in the 70s, like 74. So this was a remarkable thing back then. It was kind of a novel idea, like, hey, what if we put a recipe in a picture book, and then people want to like check it out and then make the recipe? Some brilliant person came up with that one for the first time. And now it's standard operating procedure. In fact, when there are books that don't have recipes in the back, there was a book that came out this year. I will not name names, but it didn't have a recipe at the back. And I felt myself weirdly infuriated. I was like, how dare they?
On Serious Eats, Kenji created some recipes that didn't make it into the book to accompany the book.
That is very cool. That's something that I really enjoy. And I find this more in chapter books for kids than for picture books. But I have noticed there are certain books, A Tangle of Knots by Lisa Graff, where she had to invent cake recipes that would reflect people's personalities. So she needed like a recipe that sounds disgusting, but that is actually really good. And she tried a garlic cake and that didn't really work. And she tried a chocolate cake with avocado instead of butter. And that did work, but it did not work for the frosting. So that is one example. So there are authors who will do that. They're like, I will make a chocolate chip recipe, but with thyme and a citrus zest. And that's Midsummer Magic, I believe is the name of that one. And yeah, they're just wonderful ideas that go into them. I'm also very taken with a lot of picture book biographies that center around food in some way. For example, like one of my favorites of all time involves the invention of ramen. And not ramen that you would, you know, hand make at home, but instant ramen. And there is a fascinating story behind that. It was called Magic Ramen, The Story of Momofuku Ando. It was by Andrea Wang. And it was just about the most fun you can have in a book. Completely historically accurate, wonderful art. And then there was another one that came out this year, which I just thought was a hoot, which was about the invention of nachos. And that's Nachos Nachos, the story behind the world's favorite snack. And I think that was by Sandra Nickel. So books about the invention of food. There's a bunch about George Crumb, who invented the potato chip. You know, these are fun ideas. Like someone invented one of your favorite foods. Is there a story behind that? Often there is. The Toll House Cookie Lady gets a picture book as well. I mean, you name the person who invented the food. Probably either working on that book or it has come out already.
And maybe as Kenji's daughter gets older, he's going to write one of those.
That would be a great idea. He could do an autobiography. That's happened a fair amount.
There is a food truck book that was written by someone who used to write for Serious Eats called Alexandra. And she was a children's book editor. Alexandra Penfold?
Oh, yes. Alexandra Penfold, who shares my birthday. We're good friends.
Kenji told me he talked to Alexandra a lot. And she used to have a food blog called Brownie and Blondie. And then wrote the Food Truck book, which wasn't a children's book.
the book that I was trying to think of earlier. It's Chef Roy Choi and the Street Food Remix. This is a great, fun story. You know, I once had a kid come up to my library and he was like, I have to do a book report on somebody alive. And let me tell you, that can be a little difficult to find sometimes. But when you've got a book like this, where it just talks about how he came up with his whole idea for his food trucks and how he went from job to job before he really figured out what he was interested in, and then just about the food itself, it's great. And it comes from a publisher that's actually called Readers to Eaters.
That's funny. I know Roy. He's great.
Really?
And when did it come out?
About 4 or 5 years ago, I want to say. Yeah.
He wrote a fantastic memoir called L.A. Sun. Roy, of course, made his name with food trucks called koji. They were taco trucks where he would use Korean sauces and ingredients. And there are still koji trucks all over LA. So that's not a picture book.
No, that's a picture book biography. He even found the graffiti artist who does the art for it.
He's really into graffiti.
The graffiti art is fantastic in that book.
That's so cool. Well, this has been awesome. So it sounds like you would encourage Kenji to keep going with this children's book series.
He should continue the book series. I think he should branch out. I think he should try new things. I mean, obviously he's got a talent for it. So if he's good at it, he should keep going.
I'll tell him you said that. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on Special Sauce, Betsy. I really, really appreciate it. It was really fun.
Thanks for having me.
My last conversation with Kenji about Every Night is Pizza Night was in August. Now, 4 more months into the pandemic, with the holiday season just underway, I thought I'd check in with him again. Never one to rest, Kenji has moved to Seattle, embarked on a digital book tour to support the Best American Food Writing 2020, which he guest edited, and because he wasn't busy enough, just turned in his new cookbook on wok cooking. Is that correct? Did I get all that right?
Yeah, sounds mostly right.
I was going to ask you what's going on, my friend, but I guess the answer is quite a lot.
Currently, it's just photographs right now. You know, I turned the manuscript for my wok book about 2 weeks ago, and so now I have like 1,000 photos to take over the next month or so.
A mere 1,000 photos. But the problem with your 1,000 photos, that means you have to make every dish in the book, right?
Virtually. You know, some of them I was photographing as I went, but a lot of those photos I'm retaking. So yes, but I've hooked up with a nurse who runs a COVID ward here, and every recipe in the book is going to be served to this team at this COVID ward at the Seattle Children's Hospital. I ordered 1,000 cardboard takeout boxes. Every day I do a photo shoot of 5 or 6 dishes, and then I pack up like 20 meals and bring them over there before I do the next day's shopping.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. So I talked with a children's book expert, this woman, Betsy Bird, who has like a children's book podcast and is a librarian at the Evanston Library, about your book, which she really enjoyed. But one of the things she pointed out, and I don't think we talked that much about this in our original conversation, was how historically white children's books have been in terms of the authors and the subject. And she said that Every Night is Pizza Night's multicultural characters and subject was one thing she particularly enjoyed. Can you talk a little bit about how the book's multicultural perspective came about?
Yeah, well, that's sort of the main theme of the book, right? Obviously, the character herself and her family is based loosely on my family. You know, that was sort of the whole point of the book, was that we wanted this girl to be introduced to other cultures through the lens of food, you know, which I think is, you know, it's not the only way, but it is a really easy entry point into understanding other cultures, because everybody eats and food is different all around the world. And food is not just about, you know, what you stick in your mouth with a fork. It's also about the historical aspects and what food means to people in various capacities. So food always seems like an easy and direct link to other people's cultures. So that seemed like a natural theme for the book. And then, you know, as far as the characters that she meets, Both Gigi and I grew up in cities, so the idea of having a sort of multicultural neighborhood seemed kind of natural. You know, it originally wasn't that. Originally, the girl was going to be traveling around the world, and we didn't really stop and think, like, all right, like, well, how is, like, a four-year-old or five-year-old getting around the world by herself with her dog? And we just thought, well, you know, whatever, that's sort of the... That's just the magic of children's books. But I was very wisely told by my editor, no, you should figure out a way to like make it more realistic so that kids can, you know, can attach to it, because the themes in the story are very sort of realistic, and it's not, you know, it's not a particularly fantastical book. So we had this idea to put it in a city, and that seemed to make a lot more sense, because, you know, that way it's like she can start in her own house and then she goes down the hall. You know, she lives in an apartment building, so she can go down the hall, she can go to a different floor, then she can go outside the building, and sort of she has this kind of expanding universe within the book that starts with just her in her own kitchen and then ends up spanning the whole neighborhood.
Right. She can go around the world in a walk in your neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to tell people that you could go around the world in a subway token in the New York City subway system.
Oh, yeah.
Some people may not know your background and your wife's background in terms of where you came from.
Yeah, well, my mom and my grandparents came here. So my mom came here before my grandparents, actually. She came to the U.S. She's from Nagoya, grew up in Tokyo, and she came to the U.S. when she was 16. To California. My father was from Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, Johnstown, which I think was in the news a few times this year, because I think Trump gave a speech there. But my dad's from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and he went to school out in California, so that's where my parents met. And then my mother's parents, the Japanese side, they came over to the U.S. a little before I was born. So we grew up in New York. I was born in Boston, but we grew up in New York. I grew up in New York, where we had an apartment and on the 10th floor of the building, and my grandparents had the same apartment on the 9th floor. So, you know, it was virtually a Japanese household because my dad worked a lot. And so I grew up basically with my two Japanese grandparents and my mother. My wife, Audrey, is from Colombia. So she came to the U.S., actually the only person in her family to leave the country permanently, at least. But she came to the U.S. for college, and that's where we met. So our daughter, Alicia, is half Colombian, quarter Japanese, and a quarter American.
Right. So is it difficult for you to switch gears so frequently? You know, you seem to move so easily from children's books, editing a collection of other people's food writing, just finishing your new cookbook, doing a YouTube video. And I've also heard that your new cookbook is not quite as short as Every Night is Pizza Night.
No, well, the manuscript is 1,013 pages. And it's currently about as long as the first cookbook, a little bit longer than the first cookbook. So I'm sure something's going to happen there, whether it's cuts or, you know, or maybe turning it into two volumes, which I would prefer. But I actually have to have a discussion with Melanie about that, my editor Melanie, about that, I think this week. It is difficult. I mean, obviously, I think I work pretty hard on all these things, you know, but the difficult thing for me is learning to say no to new projects.
I think that's happened between you and me. I call you with an idea, and you say, yeah, that's great. And then you like text me, you're like, I don't think I can do that now. I think I have too many things on my plate.
I've been trying to learn to say no over the last few years. So that was, so maybe one of your ideas was probably one of the first casualties of that. Certainly writing the book, the first children's book was really difficult because it was a completely new thing for me. I've developed sort of a voice as a recipe writer and as a writer for, you know, a food writer, but that's a completely different non-applicable voice to children's writing. And I'm sure, you know, as you know, as any writer knows, that, you know, finding the voice is the most difficult part. The rest is all practice. There's good writing and there's bad writing, and there's different ways to do it, but you can push words around for a long time until you get it right.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to really find sort of that essence and that voice that makes the writing unique and it makes it engaging. And with a children's book, it has to engage the child, but it also has to engage the adult, because as a parent, you know, like you have to read the same books over and over and over. And if that book is going to be an annoying book, then you're not going to recommend it to your friends. So, you know, a children's book has to work for adults and for children. And so finding the voice, you know, finding that tone that works was difficult.
Betsy Bird did notice your reference to what's the British comedian's name? Eddie Izzard. That's pretty cool.
There's quite a few references. I mean, there's a Ghostbusters reference. I think there's probably a Star Wars reference in there. Yes, there's an Eddie Izzard reference because the father walks away from the shops mumbling, "I long for a grapefruit," which is a punchline to an Eddie. It's a joke. His joke about squirrels, where every once in a while, the squirrel will pick up the nut and throw it on the ground and say, "Fucking nuts, I long for a grapefruit."
Have many other people noticed it besides Betsy Bird?
Some people have on Twitter. I think some people have mentioned it. It was, you know, it was mostly for all of my friends who know that I'm a big Eddie Izzard fan. Some people have noticed it for sure, but I didn't expect it to be a well-recognized reference. There's a Mitch Hedberg reference in there also. He has a joke about how he likes to eat a bowl of rice whenever he's hungry and he wants 1,000 of something. There's a line in the book where she says, "Bryce, like, you're so delicious and there's so many of you," which was a sort of obtuse Mitch Hedberg reference. Yeah, there's a bunch of little things in there for adults that I was hoping would, you know, at least one of the references in there would resonate, yeah.
And who is Mitch Hedberg? I must...
He's a comedian who passed away, but well-known for his one-liners.
Got it.
Like, "I used to do drugs. I still do, but I used to also."
So what's next? I guess the book's going to come out. You'll finish the photographs, and then you'll just keep doing your thing.
I want to work on some more children's books. But, you know, what's next is I'm going to take a little break.
I hope Audrey knows that.
After the new year, I'll have turned in my book. I'm still involved with the restaurant on a sort of consulting advisory level, but not in the day-to-day operations anymore because obviously I'm not in San Mateo. So I won't have that on my plate. I'll have moved to a new city and, yeah, take a little break. I think work on the house for a while. I'll do some woodworking.
And maybe not a lot of people know this. You're one of the handiest people I've ever met. You can do a lot of stuff with your hands. You can build shelves.
Yes, there's definitely a lot of shelf building in my future.
So finally, can you give us some holiday gift picks, like one for less than $10, one for less than $50, and maybe one for less than $100?
Under $50, I would recommend that you buy, whoever cooks in your household, buy them a mortar and pestle, like a granite one. There's a Serious Eats guide to mortar and pestles. I think the one that's linked there currently from like Amazon is like up to $180 or something like that, just because of demand, I think probably from the Serious Eats article. But you can find like a bunch of comparable ones for under $50. A granite mortar and pestle, 8 inches across with a 2 to 3 cup capacity. That's what you should have.
Got it.
And those should run around $40 to $45. For under $10, I would check out, let's see.
How much is a good microplaner?
A good microplane is probably $13, $15 around there. Yeah, microplane's a good stocking stuffer for sure. I think I've put that on my gift guides in the past. And for under $100, a nice big cutting board. A big wooden cutting board, because I think most people have cutting boards that are way too small and it makes working in the kitchen difficult and it makes it messier. So like having a nice big work surface so that you don't have to worry about bits of scallion flying off onto your counter. Everything gets contained on the board. Oh, you know what else would be good for under $10? For sure that's under $10. A bench scraper. Even the cheapest ones will work just fine. Something that you can use to scrape stuff off your cutting board into a bowl or into a pot or whatever. That aside from my actual knife and cutting board, that's probably the tool I use most in my kitchen.
And Serious Eats, I think, has a sort of autograph model wooden cutting board, but I think it's more expensive than $100. And what about the idea of foregoing gift exchanges this year during the pandemic and using the money to support worthy food-related causes?
I think that's great. We're probably going to be doing something similar to that, at least keeping our gifts very small this year and only to our closest friends and family. Yeah, currently the organization I'm raising money for is No Kid Hungry. They do good work all the time, but it's especially necessary right now during the pandemic. I did this salt box sale that actually sold out in 20 seconds, but that is a charity fundraiser. We're going to be auctioning off also a signed version of it. And I'll have my own page on No Kid Hungry where people can donate to enter to win this signed salt box. But also I'll be matching all the donations on that page.
You actually helped design this salt box, right?
It's actually designed off of a box that I've owned for, I can't remember, 15 or 20 years or so, that shows up in my video all the time. I got it from an ex-girlfriend who bought it from a supermarket in London, I think. It's just a really well-designed box that I can't find anywhere because I don't think it's made anymore. And people always ask me where I got it from. The other thing is if you get any of my books, if you're looking for my books, if you go to bookshop.org/shop/KenjiLopezAlt, 10% of those funds are going to independent bookstores around the country, and then another 10% is also going to No Kid Hungry.
Got it. I just think somehow the idea of giving expensive gifts this year seems silly, almost counterproductive.
What might be a good gift is restaurant gift certificates. Restaurants can definitely use help. I've been working with Grace Young, who's the author of Stir Frying to Heaven's Edge, and she started this hashtag on Twitter and Instagram. I think she'd actually worked with Dan Souza from Cooks Illustrated on this, the Save Chinese Restaurants hashtag. The idea is that you order food from your favorite Chinese restaurant, mom and pop restaurant, and all you do is post pictures of it with the hashtag. That's actually going to be another way that people who want to help right now in a different way, people can use that hashtag to also enter this salt box giveaway that I'm doing. So good way to support your local Chinese restaurant and also enter this raffle and get some money going towards No Kid Hungry.
Kenji will be back in the new year with some new Ask Kenjis. Please stay safe and healthy, serious eaters, during the holiday season. Wear a mask and practice social distancing as the pandemic enters a dangerous new phase. I can tell you that this year, my family's gift giving is going to involve giving back to the very food community that provides sustenance to every American. That means donating to worthy organizations like the one Kenji mentioned, No Kid Hungry, or Feeding America, both of which combat the food insecurity an estimated 54 million Americans are suffering from during the pandemic. Also, consider buying gift certificates at your favorite neighborhood restaurants. Kenji specifically mentions the worthy campaign #SaveChineseRestaurants that cookbook author Grace Young has started. You can also donate to SaveRestaurants.com, which is trying to get legislation passed to save both the thousands of restaurants at risk during the pandemic and the jobs of the millions of people who work in these restaurants and the folks who supply them with meat, fish, and produce. Or give a gift of a CSA membership to support your local farmers. This is a different kind of gift guide, I know, but it's of vital, life-saving importance to everyone involved in the food community. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is a production of Dot Dash, produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. The theme music and sound effects are by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.